Thanks. And thanks, Bridget and Clint, for the invitation. It's always great to be at the NRAM meeting. There is a lot of, or mostly technical discussions, which is what I personally enjoy. So faceplates. I have animations here. So just a brief introduction about the theory behind faceplates, and the theory is actually very simple, as you would see. So the electron microscope optically can be described in a very similar fashion like a light microscope. So the optics, the image formation can be also described in terms of Fourier optics, where we have an object wave immediately after the sample. Then by calculating a Fourier transform, we can predict what the wave will be at the back focal plane or the diffraction plane. And this is where the theoretical model of image formation is used to calculate the aberration function, or the what we call it simply a contrast transfer function. So it's typically a complex function which multiplies this wave at the back focal plane or the diffraction plane. And then by another Fourier transform and taking the power of the wave, we calculate the image intensity. So this is the basic Fourier optics of the microscope. Now the faceplate comes at the back focal plane, typically, where it's an additional parameter into this aberration function or the contrast transfer function. Now, simplifying things in terms of weak object contrast transfer, we have the weak object phase contrast transfer function, which maybe some of you are familiar with. It typically contains the defocus and the spherical aberration terms. And the faceplate adds just another additional constant, or it should be constant. This is the phase shift. Now, you would see that with the Volta faceplate, this is not constant, and it can change over time. But it's just one more parameter. And this parameter doesn't depend on the spatial frequency. So in principle, we assume it's constant for all the frequencies. Now, with an ideal faceplate, which has a phase shift of 90 degrees or half pi, this will result in converting the standard sine type of phase contrast transfer function into a cosine type. And the major advantage or benefit there is that we recover the low spatial frequencies, which are typically heavily suppressed by the sine type contrast transfer function. And in biology, this means we get a very strong boost in contrast, in the overall contrast in the image. And this allows us to see everything kind of much easier. So here you see on the left the standard 1.5 micron defocus cryo-EM image of 20S proteosomes in ice. And on the left, on the right, you see the same sample, but with the faceplate in focus. Now, the faceplates theoretically allow us to collect data in focus. And that's kind of the optimal way to use them. But in practice, it turns out it's very difficult, because in focus means that we have to be very accurately focused. And that's not very easy to do. And it takes time if you try to do it. So your data acquisition is drastically slowed down. So we no longer use the in focus approach with the faceplate. We combine the faceplate with a little bit of defocus. So as I mentioned in the beginning, the faceplate modifies the wave at the back focal plane, and this is where it usually is situated. Now, there are other designs which have been proposed and tried in the past, which involve transfer lenses, where we create a magnified, for example, diffraction plane where we can use the faceplate. But from a standpoint of a manufacturer, they want to do the least possible modifications to their microscope. So the easiest way to implement it is just to replace the objective lens aperture with the faceplate. And this is what is done with the Volta faceplate. Now, the difference between the Volta faceplate and previous designs, like the Zernike faceplate, is that it has no hole. The Zernike faceplate consists of a thin material film with a small hole, and there the phase shift difference between the central beam and the scattered electrons is created by the inner potential of the material. So by tuning the thickness of the film, you can tune your phase shift. Unfortunately, this type of faceplate had many issues, including aging, so something happened over time and it changed its properties. And additionally, you had to precisely center this hole on the beam, which is not a trivial procedure. And it's actually, we were thinking at some point to automate it, but it's not very easy. And it would have been much more difficult to automate the Zernike faceplate. With the Volta faceplate, the beam interacts with the film, and it generates a phase shift, which, you know, it's like a beam-induced phase shift, which, of course, then will evolve with time. So here you see image series, so it should start to animate. On the left, you see the image, and on the right, you see the power spectrum. This is a very old data, and it also has some astigmatism. But what you see here is the contrast of the image increases, and also you see the additional phase shift in the power spectrum as each consecutive image is taken. This is a more accurate plot of what's happening. So the longer we radiate the Volta faceplate, the more phase shift we get. So we have to keep that in mind when collecting data. For single particle analysis, This means we will have an additional parameter in our CTF fit. So we have to take into account the fact that the phase shift is not constant, it changes. And for tomography, you also have to pre-radiate the phase plate where you want to start your tilt series at a particular phase shift where the contrast is already pretty good. So then during the tilt series, the additional dose on the phase plate or the additional exposure on the phase plate will increase the phase shift and not too much. So these are the questions which Bridget proposed, and I actually very much like them, so I just stick to them. So the first one is, are phase plates key to high resolution structures of small and heterogeneous particles? So this is a very basic question, and I cannot give a firm answer yet. So we can just guess at this moment, and we need more experience in probably image simulations. Second, can we make them easier to use? So I'll give a few comments on that. What are the remaining issues? So this is one of the most interesting questions. I will also comment on that. And finally, what kind of progress can we expect in the near future with phase plates? So the first one. Now, starting already with Richard Henderson in 1995, the famous seminal paper on what can be done with electrons, neutrons, and X-rays, he had a prediction of the smallest particle that can be solved with single particles, assuming ideal imaging conditions. So perfect phase contrast microscope, everything perfect, perfect detector, and so on. Now, nowadays, I'm sure Chris and probably Richard are working on revising this one, and I think they have or will have an even smaller estimate of what how small can we go. But anyways, I think the general tendency will remain the same. So Richard expected that the size of the smallest size of particles that can be solved is 38 over C square kilodaltons. Now, C is the contrast of the image. And in this case, the contrast is assumed to be uniform for all frequencies. Of course, the phase plate gives you mostly boost to the low frequencies, but still, we can expect some dependence on that because the low frequencies will improve our alignment and maybe assignment accuracies of the angular orientation. So you see here that the square root of the contrast is in the denominator, and that means that the higher the contrast, the smaller the particle we can solve. But this is just kind of a general idea of how it depends, how the size of the particle depends on the contrast. And another estimate he gave is that the number of particles is 38,000 over D, where D is the resolution in angstrom. So this is, again, a pretty kind of, we are still, these estimates are still optimistic by compared to what we do in practice nowadays, but we are getting closer and closer to them. Now, in terms of simulations, there are a few papers already done, but unfortunately, they were all done during the blobology days, so before the resolution revolution, and that's actually a very important factor, which I will explain a bit later. So this is a paper by a Taiwanese group, and they simulated images of several different proteins. You see here the proteins and the molecular weights. Now, the estimates they gave for an ideal phase plate and a conventional are kind of very optimistic in a sense and also pessimistic. So what's happening with the ideal phase plate means no loss, no distortions and so on. It's actually what we are doing nowadays. With recent data sets we have, for example, for 20S proteasome and for hemoglobin, we are pretty close to the numbers they cited here for an ideal phase plate, which shows that their simulations were probably a bit pessimistic regarding the phase plate. Now, for the defocused approach, you see that it's actually quite pessimistic in this case. So they expect that you need tons of particles to reach 3.3 angstrom with such a complex. And nowadays, I'm sure there are many examples where people can reach such resolutions or even better with less particles. So the simulation overall was a bit off. Now, more recently, Bob Glazer and Ivan Nogales' group, they did the simulation, again, trying to measure how much benefit there will be of using a phase plate. So what they did is they simulated images of 100 kilodalton particles, and then here they calculated the cross-correlation maxima and the alignment accuracies of the particles. So the pluses here on the x-axis means there is a particle there, so it's a positive control, and the minus means there was no particle, just noise. So you can see here the defocused approach produces a kind of lower cross-correlation peaks, and the faceplate, the number next to the faceplate, this means the cut-on frequency. And the Volta faceplate is, in practice, between 250 and 500, so it's somewhere around here. So already we see a big advantage in the ability to, in the cross-correlation peaks, but also in terms of alignment accuracies, you see the faceplate seems to perform much better in terms of how accurately the particles were aligned. Now, here, this was a simulation of how far can we go with distinguishing different conformations, or in this case, a heterogeneity based on presence or absence of small components. So they used the 200 kilodalton protein and then added to remove the small components. And here you see the effect is not as drastic, but still the faceplate shows a bit better ability to distinguish the correct assignment of particles. So we expect advantages in both areas, the going to small particles and heterogeneity, but we still cannot quantify them very accurately. Now, in terms of actual data, this is so the other way we can judge the performance. One way would be to do simulations and try to do them as close to reality as possible. The other way would be to just collect a lot of data and from there kind of make conclusions. So this is what we have done so far with the faceplate. Of course, the proteasome, this is nothing special there. The peroxyrhodopsin 3, it's not very small, but there was a problem with the orientation. So we had to use thick ice to get variable orientations. The nucleosome, it's kind of smallish, and this view, the top view, is typically kind of low in contrast. So at least that's the problem I was told by Sarah Sandin, the collaborator on this project. So they had issues with finding and aligning those. The GPCR we did earlier this year, it's kind of smallish in size, 150. Of course, that's also being done by conventional approach. And this one also had some, the calcitonin ones, had some flexibility. So the N-terminus was flopping around, and there part of the G-protein was also moving. Now, more recently, we have a new GPCR structure, which is currently being submitted. It's the GLP-1. And this is actually the same GPCR which Yorgos Kiniotis solved with the conventional approach. This one is much more rigid than this one. So this one reached 3.3 angstrom, which is quite a bit better in terms of the ability to model it. And the only issue we had, the main issue we had, and actually there, it's not a real issue with the faceplate, is kind of smallish in size. So there was no challenge in terms of preferred orientation or flexibility. RPN1 is a 100 kilodalton protein, which is a subunit of the 26S proteasome. This one had a major issue with preferred orientation. So we tried many things. We couldn't solve it. And in the end, actually, we just reprocessed the data set with a motion core 2, and I guess the new version of Reliant, it shouldn't make any difference, but it went from 4.1 to 3.8, and we are already kind of satisfied with that because we have wasted too much time on this one, and this should be enough for kind of making a rough model of the subunit. And hemoglobin, finally, the smallest one we have done so far, 64 kilodalton, so the only issue we had with hemoglobin was the small size, and again, the faceplate hopefully helped with that. Okay, so trying to answer the first question, this is what I currently think is the state. So faceplates seem to help with particles smaller than 200 kilodalton. We have no direct evidence, at least we don't have apples to apples comparison. I wish we had the microscope time to collect, you know, conventional and faceplate data set for each of the projects we have, but microscope time, as everybody in this room I'm sure knows, is very expensive or in very high demand. So for particles under 100 kilodaltons, I believe at this stage that the faceplates will definitely be key in solving the structures, at least to atomic resolutions or near atomic resolutions. The heterogeneity is very difficult to judge because it's on case-by-case basis. You have many different types, and it's difficult to do any prediction. But you know, from general principles, I would say yes, the faceplate should help because the low frequencies should somehow improve the classification accuracy. The previous image simulations were all done before the resolution. So what are the main points here? They didn't take into account the new methods such as frame alignment and dose weighting. And these are actually, which are one of the main drivers of the revolution. So the frame alignment should be actually benefit from the faceplates because as we discussed during the Jones talk previously, the faceplate with the higher contrast should enable us to actually do what Bob Glaser called superfractionation. So we should be able to cut the per frame dose at least in half, if not even more, and still be able to align our frames. And the main benefit there is, as Richard Henderson and many others point out, is these first few electrons, which are actually the best electrons, they carry the most and the highest frequency information, are typically suppressed now, either by throwing away the first frames or when you do particle portioning Reliant, you see that the B factors it measures for those frames are quite low. It's just because the beam-induced movement is so fast in these frames. So by doing this superfractionation, and hopefully with the K2, We can do even non-linear fractionation, when you collect more frames in the beginning of the exposure and then you kind of distribute them less, more sparsely in the end of the exposure when things don't move that much. This should hopefully, and the faceplates in combination with that should improve the performance. The dose weighting, on the other hand, actually gives a big improvement for the conventional approach. As again, during the previous talk was asked and discussed, we can do very long exposures nowadays, and this can bring you the low frequencies back by doing the proper dose weighting and using much longer exposure. So this can help solve the structures of small particles with the conventional approach. And yeah, so combining all these new developments, we have to do accurate image simulation, so as accurate as possible. So I already had an intern student working on this, but he had to leave, so he was only for 3 months in the lab, and he couldn't finish that. So the idea is you take a PDB model, you create projections, then you do frame simulations, including you know, individual particle movements and so on, so to actually simulate movies. And then these movies you put into whichever pipeline of image processing you like to test and see what the performance is like. This will not answer the questions, in absolute terms, but it will give us an ability to compare different conditions, at least relatively, like faceplate, no faceplate, and particle sizes, defocuses, and so on. So we definitely need something like that. Okay, so moving on to the second question. Can we make the faceplates easier to use? Well, the main difficulties in using the faceplate nowadays, or in general, are the alignments, the additional steps you have to take when using them. So the first one is the on-plane condition. This means focusing the beam on the faceplate. So we have the crossover on the faceplate film. If it's not focused there, what you would see is actually a projection of the pattern of the faceplate. This alignment is not very difficult to learn. And I hope if people here in the audience have used the faceplate, maybe they can comment better on that, because for me and for Mariam, it's already kind of a non-issue. But I think this is not a big and difficult thing to learn. The second one is the beam shift pivot points. And this one is more important for tomography, but also in cases like, for example, the poster from NRAM where they showed the apoferritin, they used the stage shifts to move to the different acquisition areas for the faceplate. The issue is if you use image shift, like you have to do in tomography when you do the tracking, the beam, if these are not aligned properly, the beam will move on the faceplate. So you do image shift and then the beam moves on the faceplate and you lose the phase shift in your image. So by doing the beam shift pivot points, you are making sure that when you do image shifts, the beam stays on the same position on the faceplate and you keep the phase shift. And this one is a bit more tricky. The alignment procedure currently, which is implemented in the alignment routines on the microscope, uses this Ronchigram wobbling, which can be quite confusing in the beginning. But it's also not something which is unreachable or unlearnable. So people in the lab, all people who do tomography with the faceplate in the lab are doing this alignment themselves. It just takes a bit of practice. Now, apart from the alignments, we have also the faceplate control panel. In this case, we are still in the dark ages. I mean, FEI implemented this two or more years ago, and it's still at the same state as it was then. We gave many suggestions on how this can be improved, especially we only have this next button, which means if you want to go from faceplate 1 to faceplate 50, you have to click this button 50 times. Or the other thing is there is no enumeration of the faceplate. Say one wants to be able to test all the faceplates and make sure you are using only the ones which don't show too much astigmatism or other such imaging artifacts. So there should be an ability to test the faceplates and select some of them to be skipped. Also, an ability to directly address them, so for example, instead of clicking next to specify a number. And most importantly, give us external control through scripting, which is not available yet. So we have to do hacks in terms of we simulate user interface actions to be able to externally control the faceplate. So this is very primitive and definitely needs improvement. So can we make them easier to use? I think nowadays, especially in single particle analysis, you have how many? 2, 3, 4 imaging states in terms of pixel size, and the rest of the parameters are kind of, I would say, mostly the same between different samples. You don't have to vary things too much. So if we are able to save and load the microscope state, including all the alignments as it was, it's enough to make them much easier to use, because one can, for example, an experienced user or a facility manager can sit and do these alignments accurately, and with the optics, especially on the Titan, which are so stable, you can load them several months later and they still will be almost the same. So This is something important. Unfortunately, FEI microscopes, there are ways to somehow save the exact condition of the microscope as it is, but they are not perfect. And software packages also, you know, you save your current imaging state, but it also doesn't remember everything. For example, the on-plane condition adjusts a parameter which is not saved or cannot be easily saved by this software. So we are not yet there, but I believe if we can do that, that will simplify them a lot. Now, automated faceplate quality testing and enumeration should be possible. You just have to have a software tool like O2CTF, the FEI software, or another software tool. Take images with each faceplate from a test sample, say carbon, and then measure the astigmatism at each position and how far the resolution of the CTF goes. And then one can just classify them depending on these parameters and just exclude faceplates, which are not very good. Another thing which would be interesting to do is to track the usage of each faceplate. So in principle, one can log, you know, on which day which faceplate was used for how many images and so on, and kind of make statistics. And that will also help us judge the overall performance of the Volta faceplate and how it behaves with time. Currently, we are not doing that. So it's mostly feeling and guesswork of exactly what's happening. And the future faceplates, like the laser faceplates, may be easier to use in some ways, but more difficult in other ways. For example, the laser faceplate, what would be nice is constant phase shift. And also, you know, switch button operation, turn on the faceplate, turn off the faceplate. But with the laser faceplate, you don't have material at the back focal plane. So what if you want to tune the beam shift pivot points or the on-plane condition? Because these are still things which you have to do with the laser faceplate even. So, you know, it may be we may have to insert some kind of marker or some other kind of material there when we do the alignments and then retract it to use the faceplate. So we don't know yet. We haven't started using them. What are the remaining issues? So I can comment about the Volta faceplate mostly. So the first group is the inconsistency in faceplate behavior. So depending on the lab and people I talk to, some say our faceplate is fast, our faceplate is slow. So there seems to be quite a bit of variation of the how fast the phase shift develops of different faceplates in different sites. And I guess this mostly has to do with the heater settings. So FEI sets different heater settings at different places. I guess even if we set all the heaters at the same settings, I still expect some variations. The second one is that there seem to be some kind of aging of the faceplate. So the speed at which the phase shift develops in the beginning after it was installed is different than the speed, say, after a few months. And another one is the old VPP spot. So we create spots on the faceplate, and in principle, they recover with time. So we can reuse these positions. But there was a discussion a few months ago or last year at the 3DM list that people see that the old spots had not disappeared even after a long time. So there may be such an issue like scarring of the film. In our case, we haven't observed it, or we actually don't pay attention to it. But it may be there may be such an issue. The second group is the methodological issue. So maybe the most the major cause of unsuccess, I would say, is probably inaccurate alignments. And here, if you can save and load the imaging states, or if some experienced user can do the alignments and then the other users just to use them, that would probably help a lot. Another one is the focusing spots issue. And this is mainly an issue with EPU. So it seems that when you use the faceplate and when the focusing images are taken with the beam tilt, the direction in which EPU tilts the beam is the same as the rows of faceplates. And then these spots which are created during focusing are near the spots used for acquisitions, and that causes issues. So the current solution is very kind of rough, so they just skip positions on the faceplate, I think one or two positions. With SiriusEM, we never had such an issue, and I guess just SiriusEM tilts in a different direction, and we are lucky with it. And the last group is the intrinsic issues of the faceplate. So there is information loss, about 18% at 200 kV and 15% at 300 kV. And that's because we have a material film there and scatters some of the electrons. And so the only way to improve that is to make the faceplate thinner. And of course, there is a much more expensive way. You can go to higher voltages, but the effect there is much less. Another intrinsic issue is there is additional astigmatism you would see when using the faceplate. It's caused by maybe two major factors. One is the waviness of the film. So the carbon film of the faceplate has some wrinkles on it. And depending where on the wrinkle, you may have a bit of asymmetric arrangement there, which causes a bit of astigmatism, and maybe some a little bit of contamination still remaining on the faceplate. But what we typically observe is maximum 100 nanometer additional astigmatism. And it, for me at least, it's not a problem. As long as you know the CTF fits work well, it seems to be not an issue. Well, the CTF fitting, this is actually one of the most important steps in image processing of faceplate data, so you have to pay particular attention on this step. It's a bit more complicated with the faceplate. So without a faceplate, in principle, you can use the default parameters for any of the CTF fitting programs, and they work pretty well. But with the faceplate, because you have this additional phase shift parameter, even though it's only one parameter, it complicates things much more, and then one has to pay more attention. So non-constant phase shift complicates the CTF fitting. Now, if we had a faceplate with a constant phase shift, like the laser faceplate, it won't be any issue. Gets dirty over time. Well, if the faceplate is inside the microscope for a year or two, you would see probably additional particles building up on it. And that's because if the microscope gets serviced, you know, the column is vented, and this venting usually moves dust particles around, and the faceplate gets dirtier. Another problem, another cause of this could be that if you exchange samples and you forget to retract the faceplate, there may be something falling from the mechanical actions above. And finally, the blown away faceplates. I've heard that from a few places, and we had the issue also on the third cryos, which are installed in Martin Street. So sometimes it seems the faceplate get blown away, I guess, during servicing and venting of the column. So here at NRAM, I heard somebody mentioned you're there on the third or on the fourth faceplate already. So this seems to be an issue. So they have to be more careful when venting, I guess, or somehow retract them further away from the center of the column.
It's the same one. It took a long time to get replaced.
But in the meantime, I heard you got damaged or blown away faceplates.
Just one that's been blown away.
Okay.
But then to get a replacement for that, a proper replacement, it took a long time.
Yeah.
Almost a year now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard some similar things from other places. So, the issue is you have to wait longer before you get it replaced, because if the one which comes is broken or blown away, then you have to wait more. So, what about the maturation or the aging of? Yep.
The ideal phase shift you want is 90 degrees, right?
Yes.
So why? Where the point you're reaching asymptotically around 100 degrees is better than where you're starting. Why do you keep getting to 100 degrees then going back down to 20? Isn't it better to stay at 100 degrees?
Well, we typically move the faceplate every X images when you collect data. And this was one day after the new faceplate was delivered. And what I did is I started the test data acquisition. And of course, I didn't expect it to be that slow. I started the data acquisition, and I saw that the phase shift is developing quite slow. So I said I will change it instead of every 50 images, every 100 images.
Why change it
but
at all?
But it's not asymptotic. It will continue. You see, some of them don't have this asymptotic behavior. So it will continue rising, and I didn't expect it to be that low. I collected the data set blindly. I didn't know what the phase shift was there. Okay. So yeah, Bob.
But you should be able. Okay, yeah, I'm confused.
Rado, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the answer to John's question is the point that you mentioned, that there's a variable amount of phase shift. So essentially the Volta patch is not growing so much in magnitude, but it's increasing in area, which produces really strange effects on the CTF. Rado mentioned that.
Yeah, but John said that why didn't we wait even longer? If I have known that it was so slow, I would have definitely collected, for example, 200 or more images per position. So I just changed at 100 because that was already twice as much as what we usually did, and I don't have this feedback until I start processing the data set and measure the CTF. So we don't have this yet, the real time feedback. Ifan.
So that means with real time on the fly, this process give you all this information right away.
Yes.
Then you can determine that much longer or, right? Is that?
Yeah, true? That's the idea. So the idea is to have real time on the fly processing, and then to judge when to move to the next faceplate once the phase shift reaches a particular number. And then you see here we have uniform intervals at which we change the faceplate, but ideally you would change it when it reaches a particular phase shift, say 130, 140 is already a bit too much. But we are still not there in terms of automation in Martin's read, so we are a bit primitive in that sense.
I mean, we certainly have that here, right? We monitor it.
But no, I suppose no matter what, that if you just look at the CTF itself, no, that would give you some idea of the range. But no, to be pinpointing that, oh, I'm at 100 or the 90, that's not going to be possible directly.
Well, you could do, you know, if the last three or four images had phase shift more than a particular number, then move, because there is definitely some fluctuations. You cannot based on single image. But you can do, you know, some kind of denoising of this information and decide when to move to the next one. Yeah.
Do you have an algorithm, a program to look at the size of the Volta spot to see when you're in a regime where it becomes too big and problematic?
No, we don't have. And the only tests I did of the size of the spot were for the original paper, and I did them on an F20. So there. What's interesting is the beam diameter is expected to be about 20, if I remember correctly, 20 or 30 nanometers. I don't remember. It's just a few tenths of nanometers. And the patch diameter is 200, 300 nanometers. So the patch is much larger than the beam. So the patch seems to be created not only by the central beam, but also by either low angle scattering around the central beam. So, you know, when you have a sample, you would have such thing. Or secondary, you know, high energy secondary or Auger electrons, which, yeah. So the way I measure the beam diameter is without a sample, of course. I try to measure it, but there definitely, when you have a sample, you would have also the beam tails are there, and you would have low angle scattering, especially with ice samples. There is a lot of, low angle scattering happening.
Radu,
yeah.
Maybe you said it already, but given this larger patch, this must translate into a low resolution regime where the faceplate does weird things. I mean, you already mentioned it. How have you estimated to what resolution we would expect a non-conform CTF because of strange patch behavior? Or size?
So I think the cut-on frequency, this is what we call the place where the phase shift kind of develops high enough. There is no kind of firm definition, but is maybe 30 to 50 nanometers periodicity. So that's like 300, 500 angstrom in Fourier space, which is really, really low. Now, the weird effects, they happen also when you have too high phase shift, but that's, that's when you get this very low frequency peak there. But typically, if the phase shift is less than 90 degrees, it's a smooth onset. So it starts from zero and then gradually goes to the phase shift value and stays there. If the phase shift is more than 90 degrees, the CTF will do something like this, go up, then cross 90 degrees and continue raising. So there is this low frequency peak, which is the weird part and which we don't have into the CTF model yet. I don't think it's worth putting it into the CTF model. It won't be difficult, probably. Chris?
Just back to the spot. Back to the spot. Have you measured the profile of the spot accurately that you're irradiating? Because if the effect that's actually creating the patch only requires extraordinarily low dose, it could be happening out into the beam tail, and that's what's causing, you know, a much larger patch than the actual Gaussian profile of the beam or something. I don't know if it's Gaussian, though. It might not be.
That's the question. We saw the way we observed the patch is we go to low mag and we defocus a lot. And then you have, you know, you see the spot with a nice defocus fringe around it, so it's not easy to measure the profile of the patch. We assumed it's a constant potential in, no potential out. Of course, it's not like that. It's probably some kind of distribution. The thing is, even if it's a top hat function, so 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, when you integrate the phase shift, you know, so you calculate three-dimensional electrostatic field, you calculate the integrate, you integrate along z, it gets very smooth. So it's very difficult to judge from the phase shift profile what the patch shape is, and even if it is sharp shape, it will still produce very smooth phase shift profile. So no, answer is no. It's kind of difficult to measure it directly. My guess is The proper way to be to do holography maybe on it, but yeah, we haven't done anything like that. Yeah.
I have a question about the curve. We see this all as well. So if you just put
Let me explain it first.
Okay.
So the idea here is that one day after it was installed, we see kind of a very slow phase shift development. Here, after 3 months, we can collect about 50 images per position. And 7 months later, we are now down to 30 images. So it gets faster and faster with time. We don't know why, but that's what's happening. So, Anchi?
So my question is that now, when we if we have the faceplate in there and stay at the same position, not doing anything, you do get the curve that's always just increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see in this plot, and also we saw it as well, when you are actually using it, you know, it will fluctuate a lot more.
Yeah.
And why is that?
You mean here in these fits?
Yeah.
I think that's the... I would say that's more issue probably of the CTF fit than the actual phase shift. But that's just a guess. Well, one could say if the beam gets deflected by sample charging or something, it may hit a little bit to the side of the patch and then the phase shift will drop a little bit or suddenly. But my feeling is this should be a continuous smooth curve. And this is actually a good point to mention that, the good place to mention that this information that the phase shift should be a smooth curve can be used as a priori information during CTF fitting. So one can do initial fits, then kind of smooth those curves or interpolate them somehow and feed this back into the CTF fitting program as a already kind of a fixed parameter. And then the CTF fits should in principle improve quite a bit. We haven't tried that yet, but that's something to think about, I guess. We haven't needed it. You know, our data sets work quite well. Even with such fluctuations, we get decent resolution, so we kind of don't bother.
So I did one of this on a cross grating. Something doesn't move, and it's always at the same position. But
and you see there, this even with cross grating.
If I go through the process, it still does something like that.
Well, then the only explanation I have is that the beam maybe fluctuates a bit, and I don't know why it would do that. But the phase shift itself shouldn't have any random, I wouldn't expect it to have any random oscillations or dips or, you know.
I just wanted to point out that if you get one commercially.
Sorry, I just wanted to point out that if you get one commercially, it won't be 1 day old. This is after evaporating the carbon.
That's 1 day after it has been put into the vacuum and heated up. And that's the time I kind of think the things start to develop. Because as long as you keep it in storage in clean atmosphere, without plastic plasticizer and other such things, it should not change over time. Yeah. Okay. So this is the focus spots issue, which I mentioned. So when collecting data, this is the strong spots are where the images were collected, and you see satellite spots here, weaker spots, which are created when the beam is tilted for taking the focusing images. And the issue with EPU is that the tilt direction seems to be in the same direction as the faceplate throws, and then you see these focusing spots can get closer to the acquisition spots. This is not a good illustration, but it's the only one I have. So the idea being is that a solution for this would be to tilt in a maybe 45 degree direction or something like this to get the spots away from the acquisition spots. Now the astigmatism, as I mentioned, we typically see around 1,000 Ångström astigmatism. This data set is a bit worse, but it's a very good, actually, parameter to keep an eye on because it shows you if your CTF fits were correct or worked or didn't work. So you have to plot the astigmatism, which is the difference between the two defocus values you get, and then it should be a continuous curve. It should not be something, for example, looking something like this. If it's something like this, that means you had issues with your CTF fits. And the other thing you see in the astigmatism plot is there are these jumps. And these jumps are actually changes when you move from faceplate to faceplate. So there could be a change when you move from one position to the other, but there shouldn't be randomness here because that means your CTF fits or not didn't work well.
Reddit?
Yeah.
You may have said it already and I missed it, but what is the origin of this extra astigmatism?
So I suppose it's due to wrinkles on the faceplate film, or there may be some mild residual contamination on the surface. I think it's wrinkles mostly. So this is what a faceplate after 2 years in the microscope looked like. So we had the first one, which we changed in February or March this year. So you see lots of these dark things on top. So this is actually a fiber. It looks like a textile fiber or something. So expect the faceplate to get dirtier and dirtier with time. So this kind of prevents them from lasting forever, one of the things. So what progress can we expect for the future? Now, for the water faceplate, it would be great if we can make it thinner. I kind of don't have high hope that we can do that with the amorphous carbon because it's already quite weak and fragile. One way to do it would be to use graphene because mechanical graphene is much stronger. The issue is how do you transfer graphene over such a large area, and that's just a practical issue. If we make it twice as half as thick, then the information loss will also drop approximately in half. Now, the expensive way, as I mentioned, is to go to higher acceleration voltages. Now, there is not only the advantage of less information loss, but you would get other advantages at the higher voltages, like, for example, the phase shift development would be much slower because the same potential will create much less phase shift for the higher energy electrons. And just top of the back of the envelope calculation shows that from 300 to 1 megawatt, you would get about one-third less information loss. Improve the software. As I mentioned, it would be nice if we can have direct addressing of the faceplates and some kind of quality number for each faceplate, say how much astigmatism we see at this position and such things. So improving the information about the faceplate and being able to use them more efficiently would be really nice. And the more consistent manufacture, this could be quite difficult. Now, making carbon films and transferring them is very trivial, but it turns out making carbon films very clean and transferring them without breaking them and so on is not a very trivial procedure in practice. So one, and there are such factors there which are very difficult to predict. So you can make them one day, they are perfect, and you do the same thing the next day and something happened, they are much, much worse. So, you know, it's a difficult process to optimize because there are no clear indications of what exactly happened and how it happened. Yeah, Bridget, do you have
a question? Make them in a clean room?
I'm not sure if they make them in the clean room. Could be, but yeah, I don't know. The water itself is the most important part, the water used to transfer the carbon, and and also the supports where you put the grids on top. And after you transfer it on the grid, how fast and in which way you drain the water behind the film, because you have the film, then you have the grid, and water always stays behind, pools behind the film. And this water, if you keep it there when it dries, no matter how clean your water was, it will always deposit something, at least around the edges of the film. And if you try to drain it very aggressively, then the fumes break because of the capillary forces. So it's a bit a tricky process. And the future, the laser faceplates. Now, Bob Glaser and Hogan Mueller in Berkeley are working on the laser faceplates, which is a focused laser beam with very high intensity, so high that the electrons will actually experience a phase shift. And this is caused by the so-called ponderomotive force. But a simple classical explanation is you have a very high intensity oscillating electric field, and when the electron comes, it experiences this field and it starts to wiggle left, right, and this elongates its optical path. So the electrons, instead of going into straight lines, now do this wiggling motion and their optical path gets longer and they experience phase shift. This is how easily to understand what's happening. And here, this is at least how I understand it. Okay, so you see the original proposals in the paper in 2010. So there were several geometries, and they focused at that time on the parabolic mirror with the electron beam passing through the focal point of the mirror. But nowadays, they switched to a different design where they have a resonant cavity consisting of two mirrors, and then the cavity is tuned for resonance, and that amplifies the laser power by 30,000 or so, I think. It's all about how precise and they call it the finesse of the cavity, how accurate these mirror surfaces are so that you get more amplification of the power. The idea here is that the laser you need is a tabletop semiconductor laser, like 7 watts or so, I think. And in this case, you need it actually a few hundred watts of a laser. So this is much more practical. They did some image simulations. Now, one small detail here is that the laser faceplate will produce the opposite phase shift to that of the Volta faceplate. So these images should be inverted. In principle, with the laser faceplate, I expect the images to be inverted in contrast, because where the laser beam is, we are retarding the electron beam. And with the Volta faceplate, we are doing the opposite. And yeah, we are really looking forward to this one. Maybe Bob can say a couple of words. The idea is, if it's not secret, I guess, that they will test it by the end of this year or in the beginning of the next year to demonstrate already some phase shift. Because this proof of concept experiment will show that, in principle, the idea works. And from there on, it's just engineering and improving the technical details in practice so that you get enough phase shift. At the moment, they have something like pi over 10 phase shift, I think, power. But it's a question of improving the optics here. And once it's done, this will be, I think, I hope, a revolution, not only for biology, but also material scientists will be very excited about this, because it's pure physics, lasers and electrons. It's amazing. Now, I have a few comments. So Elizabeth gave me kind of a burden of commenting about tomography and faceplates. Well, it's difficult. That's the general word. It's difficult. If you are doing already cryo-electron tomography and you feel bored and you want some additional challenges, then try using the faceplate. Of course, it depends if you're doing it with cryofibbed samples or with in vitro samples on quantifiers. In vitro samples on quantifiers work pretty well. There is the success rate is pretty high there. I would say even close to 100%. Now, fibbed lamellas, the success rate is less than 30%. I mean, the faceplate experiment success rate. Consider on top of that the success rate of making the lamellas and also having good areas on those lamellas. So you're getting pretty abysmal chances of getting great data there. And in general, I think that it only makes sense to use the faceplate in focus in tomography. This is because if you want to defocus and try to fit the CTFs, the doses in tomography are so low, you have to use a lot of defocus to see any CTF ring. So 3-4 or more microns defocus. And these are the same amounts of defocus you use typically without a faceplate. So in my opinion, it doesn't make sense to use the faceplate with defocus in tomography, only in focus. But then you have to focus accurately. So it's that's the difficulty, focusing accurately. So here, the main issues are phase shift fluctuations during the tilt series, and that's usually because of sample charging. Beam shift field points were not aligned properly. So when during tilt series acquisition, the software uses image shifts to compensate for stage movements. And these image shifts, if the beam shift field points are not aligned, will move the beam on the faceplate, then you lose the phase shift. Lens hysteresis, that's an important one. For example, if during the tilt series you go out of the cycle, so keeping things in a consistent cycle always helps to keep the beam on the same position on the faceplate. If you, for example, randomly decide to switch to a lower mag to check how things are or something, you immediately will cause a disturbance there, and the beam at the next image you take will probably not be at the same place on the faceplate. So this is important. Other causes, normalizations. This is how we fight with the hysteresis issues, but they also can cause additional hysteresis sometimes. So accurate focusing with the in vitro samples is not an issue. With the lamellas, which have pre-tilt, that's another big challenge there. Apart from the sample charging, we also have these focusing issues. And too much phase shift, that's usually if you pre-radiate too long or you use quite high dose for your tilt series, it may be that at the end of the tilt series you have too much phase shift, which is visible as a very kind of blurry and fuzzy looking images. I will skip this because we are late, and thanks a lot for your attention.
Rado?
Oh.
So what do you think about generating low resolution contrast with large defocuses? So would that be an alternative, at least in some cases?
Definitely. So I think Dave Eggert was playing with the idea of dynamic defocus. So you do long exposures, high dose exposures, and then you start with a low defocus, and then during the movie acquisition, you gradually crank up the defocus. You can do that with the high tension or somehow, but that's definitely something which could probably...
I mean, that's already a more sophisticated scheme. I was just thinking, collect
just
everything
just using high defocus.
5 or 10 micron defocus.
Yeah,
what
I guess
what would stop you from doing that?
Nothing. And what is stopping people from doing it? I mean, we are using the faceplate. We are collecting all the data sets with the faceplate. So I'm really, and actually Chris is working currently, I guess, on a paper where theoretically there is no reason why high defocus shouldn't produce high resolution structures. But somehow in practice, that's what's happening, you know.
Isn't that true that the high defocus attenuates the high frequency?
Theoretically, the envelopes are much, you know, much less aggressive than what people kind of think they are. So, with the field emission guns, you should be able to go to 3-4 micron defocus and still keep the high resolution information. Maybe Chris can comment on that. Yeah.
But Amadei has the microphone.
Let him comment. He's the same.
Sorry. Yeah. I mean, it's often we've had the. People have the perception that going to high defocus is unfavorable because you lose coherence by various mechanisms. We've measured this recently, and we see very little loss of coherence at all, even at 10 microns of defocus. So I think Nico's suggestion is actually a good one, and we've been thinking about this for a long time. So, and I think it is possible to go to high resolution mm-hmm. at high defocus. Sorry? Information as you go to high defocus. Spatial coherence.
Yeah, and especially with the doses, I mean the exposure rates you have to use with the Falcon 3, you go to such small spot sizes that the coherence should be, I mean, amazing.
But your information does go further out. You need a bigger box.
Correct, yeah.
Or you do the CTF phase flip on the whole image and then you box the particles. Somebody should do it, not us. Yeah.
Different topic. So since it's so tricky to make a proper faceplate, should we do it ourselves? Should we float our own carbon and deposit it on the faceplate?
You could try.
And put it back in the microscope?
If you make FEI agree to install it for you, I guess you could try it. I was thinking about trying it, but you know, with all the travel and everything else, I didn't have time recently. In principle, though, I don't think you will be more successful than them. I would say, unless you have a lot of luck or beginner's luck in this case.
But we can try.
You could
times.
Try, of course. It's just carbon. You evaporate carbon on mica, you float it on water, and you transfer it to a grid. So we still have a faceplate, which was from the original ones I made, and I made them on titanium grids because titanium is quite inert in a sense, and also it's not as plastic or as flexible as copper or other or gold, for example. So titanium seemed to work pretty well for that. 100 mesh titanium grids. This is how I made the first face plates.
Okay, maybe one last one.
Let's do one more.
Can you talk a little bit about subtomogram averaging?
Yeah.
And how that works? And does anyone have a package that actually compensates for the phase in the CTF fitting? Has anyone tried to actually account for that in subtomogram averaging?
So I maybe should put that in my opinion about tomography and faceplates. Faceplates will not give you better resolution in subtomogram averaging. It will give you worse resolution. That's our experience. What I expected to help with is probably something similar like in single particle analysis, the ability to average smaller particles. But we haven't tried anything like that yet. So. In general, I would say if you plan to do subtomogram averaging, you're better off not using the faceplate. Your life will be so much easier. If you want to do cellular morphology or, you know, exploring the organization of the cell or something, faceplates is great. If you plan to segment tomograms, faceplate is great. If you want to do subtomogram averaging, you would get a little bit worse resolution than, at best, a little bit worse resolution than without the faceplate. You have an information loss, and also the in focus acquisition. That's how I always consider the data should be collected in tomography. always you have the errors in focusing. So that's why. In perfect conditions, like we had the paper in JSB, it produces roughly the same resolution, or a little bit better than without the faceplate, with ribosomes. But conditions are never perfect, so especially in cellular tomography.
But my question, though, is that if you say that in focus, the problem with keeping that in focus is a problem, but the amount of defocus that's changing probably is still beyond the range where a subtomogram can be achieved. So
not
why would that be an issue?
Not that much. So 100 nanometer error is already, I don't know if I have the graph here, is already limiting you to 10 angstrom or so. And yeah. What is it? So 10 angstrom, yeah, plus minus roughly 200 nanometers. And that's not a big error, considering how far your focusing area is from the acquisition area. Usually it's a couple of microns or so. You know, it's 1 over 10 kind of ratio. And yeah.